And the question of the nuclear debt is interesting, actually. Like, you get lots of now sort of arraigners really citing John Mearsheimer and saying, look, John Mearsheimer saying that you guys really should have a nuclear deterrent, and that's the only thing that will actually resolve the issue.
Everyone, this is BungaCast, the global politics podcast at the end of history. I'm Alex Oculi in São Paulo, Brazil. Just next door in Rio de Janeiro, the last day of the 17th BRICS summit is going on. We're recording this on Tuesday, the 8th of July. On Sunday, the BRICS, which is, if you're not aware, an alliance which is no longer just Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, but now includes Saudi Arabia, Egypt, the UAE, Ethiopia, Indonesia, and Iran. Well, the BRICS issued this big communique about a whole bunch of issues, but which also included condemnation of the military strikes on Iran and the war on Gaza, but has to be said in relatively soft terms. They also reiterated the importance of the dollar. So it's unclear what this bloc actually is and wants, insofar as it stands ostensibly against the US-led order or unilateral US disorder. But that's all for another day. Today, we're talking specifically about Iran. And I mentioned the BRICS just because it's a little gesture to multipolarity, question mark. But what we want to do here is talk about Iran after the 12-day war. Now, I don't know what you think about this 12-day war, but for me, it was so hyper-real that it's unclear what exactly constituted outright hostilities and what was just for show. But the 12-day war, I looked it up, and it has its own Wikipedia page. So I guess it must be real. I guess that's the ultimate arbiter of the reality of things. So what we want to do today is look beyond the 12-day war, both backwards and forwards. We've talked about Iran several times on this podcast in dedicated episodes, such as back in 2020 upon the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, and in relation to the wider region multiple times. What is interesting to talk about Iran now is because a year and 9 months on from Hamas's 7th of October attack on Israel, the map of the region looks very different. So Hamas and Hezbollah have been humbled. The Assad regime in Syria is gone, and you can check out an episode specifically on that with Jean Bajalan from a few months back. And Iran, as a consequence, has been weakened. And then in longer historical scope, it seems to me that the geopolitics of West Asia aren't any more configured by Jewish versus Arab nationalism, but rather by an Iran-centered mostly Shia alliance, maybe the so-called axis of resistance. And on the other side, an increasingly religiously inflected Zionism in alliance by default, I guess, with Sunni states, mainly monarchies. So this is rather different to the 20th century map, late 20th century map of the Middle East. So to talk about all this and more, I'd like to welcome, and I forgot to ask you how to pronounce your name. So I'm going to ask you to say your name, because I forgot to do this in the chat beforehand.
Just Eskander Siddiqui is fine.
Eskander Siddiqui. Okay. Yeah, so Eskander Siddiqui is a historian at the University of York, the author of Revolution and Its Discontents, Political Thought and Reform in Iran. We're mainly going to be talking about geopolitics, but we will hopefully get on to a little bit of political thought. Eskander, hi, welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Really good to see you.
Yeah, so we are going to start with, with the axis of resistance. Now, I assume we're about the same age. I mean, for me at least, you know, observing from very much afar, I was of an age that the naming of the axis of evil, Iran, Iraq, and North Korea, for those who have forgotten, that was a pretty formative moment for me politically, observing all of that. If I recall correctly, they only subbed in North Korea for Syria at the last moment so that it wouldn't all be Muslim countries. I think that was like a last minute substitution by the speechwriter. So, you know, these things maybe are coined off the hoof. But then you've got the axis of resistance, which is the ostensible opposition to that. So can you tell us a little bit about how that was formed? And what is it really? Is it really an axis? Is it an alliance?
Okay. So, I mean, the Axis of Resistance obviously emerges really as a term, I guess, after 2003, and then really, I guess, is sort of used more widely, particularly after the Israeli-Hezbollah conflict of 2006. And yeah, I guess it's called an axis largely because it is based upon the alliance between Iran and Syria, which is consolidated after the revolution and then obviously in the course of the Iran-Iraq war. So following the invasion of Iran by Iraq in September of 1980, Syria basically remains the sort of the foremost and really the only sort of steadfast ally of the Islamic Republic through that conflict. And that's in large part, at least it begins, because of the profound like enmity between the two Ba'athist regimes in both Syria and Iraq. Obviously, Hezbollah is really, I mean, in many ways, really it's the Hezbollah-Iran alliance, which is the key, which is the core of this. And that is very much rooted in a political, ideological, like affinity. Absolutely. And obviously, Hezbollah emerges in response to the 1982 invasion of Lebanon by Israel, which was originally sort of set out to quash sort of Fatah and the PLO and their sort of presence in Lebanon, which they were obviously using to launch attacks on Israel. And that was under sort of General Ariel Sharon at the time. And this basically relationship very much evolves, is extremely, I would say, resilient. But because obviously the Islamic Republic also lays claim to support more broadly resistance movements within the region, and they see this part of their regional strategy in a sense to drive out, not only to sort of, I guess, push back against what they see as Israeli colonization and domination of the region, but also more broadly the United States and to apply pressure. And obviously the ultimate horizon of this is to drive the United States military presence from out of the region. And this is obviously key, has long been key to Iran's sort of grand strategy. So the Axis, when we speak about, obviously there are many other players who often seem to sort of comprise part of this. So obviously Hamas in Gaza and in Palestine, Ansarullah in Yemen as well. But obviously the core of it, the heart of it, was always the Iran-Hezbollah relationship, which was heavily reliant on Syria as a kind of a hinterland for logistics in order to basically be able to get supplies in through Syria. And that was sort of the heart of it. And so when obviously the Assad regime fell in December of 2024, that was obviously a huge, huge blow there. Absolutely. But the point of the Axis is that, it is this sort of loose series of alliances. I would say many of these movements, whether it's the Houthis or Ansarullah in Yemen or Hamas, I mean, they all have their own individual and sort of origin stories, as it were, responding to local imperatives, local conditions. And a lot of it's related to obviously questions of, you know, occupation, resistance against that. And yeah, and Iran obviously has historically, I mean, there is a genuine, I would say, pan-Islamic kind of sentiment, and that sort of distinguishes Khomeinism as a form of kind of Islamic populism, I would say. So that is genuine, but I would say really since the 90s, it's also become very much part of Iran's strategy and this whole idea of cultivating what is often called, you know, strategic depth. So basically fighting or supporting allies abroad who can wage wars or in some sense act as a deterrent against both the Israeli threat and American threats potentially, so that, you know, that we don't have to fight at home, quote unquote. I mean, that's kind of how it has often rationalized sort of at least in the last, I would say, 15 years.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, and the reason why we're going to do a bit of history here, or why I'd like to ask you to tell us about it, is because, well, firstly, Iran is or rather was a revolutionary power, and so was interested in projecting its influence abroad. And to tell the story about the weakening of this alliance and indeed the loss of several of its actors, including Assad and Syria, as a way of kind of getting to where we are today. So we're going to, I guess, start backwards. And maybe we'll start a bit more on Hezbollah to try to understand where that relationship came from and its kind of development over maybe the past decade.
Yeah, so obviously we see the Israeli invasion in 1982. Actually, obviously, it affects the south of Lebanon probably most severely, really. Initially, it's interesting because there was at first sort of a trans-sectarian movement, which was led by people like Kamal Jumblatt and others in Lebanon, which were very much trying to push for a kind of a anti-sectarian sort of national liberation and quite like avowedly socialist sort of alternative. Sort of, we see this in the 70s, and this is to a large extent both crushed by the Israelis and the Syrians, basically, when with American assent in the 1970s. Then we see, obviously, the Israeli invasion of 1982, again, to sort of decisively crush the PLO. And obviously, this does ultimately result in Yasser Arafat and the PLO leaving and going to Tunis. But what we see is the evolution of, basically an overtly Shi'i Islamist resistance movement, the Islamic resistance in Lebanon. And this is basically initiated with the explicit support and backing of Iran. But again, that also needs to be, I guess, carefully calibrated because, this was very much an indigenous sort of, local to Lebanon struggle. And actually, even though Iran did send support and training, and because Iran at the same time was very much embroiled and involved in the Iran-Iraq war, and basically that was sort of seen as the key front, it was absolutely crucial to protect and sort of consolidate the regime in Iran at home and make sure that wasn't ultimately sort of overthrown or undermined by the Iraqi invasion. I mean, while Iran did support it, it also was far more preoccupied at home and actually diverted initially after sort of supporting the establishment of Hezbollah and actually then diverted resources back to Iran. It was actually a much more kind of a meager sort of support. That being said, they did very much adopt kind of the official ideology of Iran in this period. So the sort of the rule of the jurist and basically pledged, ideological fealty to the leader in Iran. But that being said, obviously, as that organization evolved, I think there's a general consensus among scholars who study this that it really sort of fundamentally recast itself as a kind of a national liberation movement, very much rooted in kind of particularly, not necessarily, but largely obviously Shia sort of areas in Lebanon, like the Bekaa Valley, or the south of Lebanon in particular, which, is mixed as well, but it's largely Shia Muslim. So, that's sort of the origins of that. And like I said previously, I mean, it was obviously highly dependent on, initially there were clashes actually with the Assad government. So the Assad with the Syrian government and the Syrian military actually in the 1980s. But then eventually there was some sort of modus vivendi and sort of understanding that was reached, because it was seen, I guess, conducive both to the Syrian state as well as Iran, as well as obviously Hezbollah. And then really, if we fast forward to 2006, that's where we saw sort of an outright, sort of this the famous 33-day sort of war conflict at that time with the Olmert government in power in Israel. And again, this appears to be sort of very much a green light by the Bush administration. There was a sense that Hezbollah could be very quickly and rapidly squashed. That didn't turn out, and actually, I think to the dismay of many, Hezbollah managed to continue to fire missiles despite this huge asymmetry of power for that period. And then eventually there was a ceasefire that was reached. And really, I mean, that had acted in Iran's view, but also I think for those who sort of defended the role of Hezbollah in the sort of the context of Lebanon, it was believed that it did act as a deterrent. And of course, they also had this precedent in 2000 where they managed to famously push out the Israeli occupation. And that was seen generally as a kind of a great achievement because it was sort of the first sort of Arab paramilitary force to eject the Israelis who had, from occupying sort of quote unquote Arab land. So it was seen as a very important kind of historical moment. 2006, again, was, as I said, it was equally important in this regard. And this was very much, up till really post 2023, sort of Hezbollah's role and more broadly, I guess, the acts of resistance was seen as an effective deterrent and check on not only aggression on Lebanon, but also, on Iran itself as well. And obviously what we saw since October 2023, and particularly then, as you sort of laid out in your introduction, with sort of the weakening, obviously, of Hezbollah. And of course, it needs to be said, this was sort of done because this was achieved really through really kind of the imposition of kind of collective punishment on the entirety of, on the Lebanese polity more broadly. And because obviously Lebanon itself is very polarized along both political and, I guess, sectarian lines, there was immense sort of pressure and criticism of Hezbollah at the time in certain quarters for, in a sense, as they saw it, dragging Lebanon into this conflict and basically which resulted in too high a cost. When Hezbollah entered into the conflict with Israel in, soon after October 7th, it was seen as basically the ultimate result of this campaign was seen as actually not only having extremely heavy costs for Lebanese society more broadly, but those who within both Israel and the United States had seen this then as, they basically tried to frame it that they, that basically obviously Hezbollah was decisively routed in many ways, not necessarily in the grand campaign, but mostly through the aerial campaign and through the intelligence penetration and obviously then the decimation of its leadership, obviously most importantly kind of the assassination of Hezbollah's secretary general and then his successor, as well as obviously the infamous pager attack. This was really, really a kind of a devastating blow to the organization, which was really trying to, has ever since been trying to, in essence, regroup. And again, we can really see from the ceasefire that was ultimately concluded, how imbalanced it turned out to be. And we know, obviously, that Israel has since, violated that ceasefire at this point hundreds of times, with basic impunity to do so. And then this was very much because of this, obviously, I guess, defanging, this fundamental sort of degrading, as it's put, of particularly Hezbollah, of course. This was sort of often then, this was then seen as paving the way then for a more aggressive, like direct sort of engagement with the Islamic Republic, which obviously in June.
Yeah, I mean, we would like to get beyond, obviously, both the left-wing interpretation by which the axis of resistance or whatever is a kind of glorious anti-imperialist struggle, and then, or indeed the right-wing interpretation from abroad as well, which is that this is just indeed an axis of evil, and try to understand mutations within it. And there's a lot to disentangle ideologically. So we don't want to obviously just deal with the geopolitical questions, but with some of the ideological ones, which at some points kind of underpin it as well as serve as justifications for it. So there's elements of nationalism, there's a more ecumenical kind of religious identity, there's a sectarian one, and there's the kind of revolutionary approaches. And these have waxed and waned in terms of when we look at the relations between the Islamic Republic and its allies. One thing I found very interesting in this essay, that long essay published in Jadalia on the whole process leading up to the 12-day war, or in fact, just before it, I think, because it was published in May, but it's an excellent recapitulation of really the history of Iran's external relations and the axis of resistance since 1979. You write that from 2013 on, and I found this quite interesting, Hezbollah and the Islamic Republic were increasingly perceived as sectarian actors committed to protecting their narrow geopolitical interests at the expense of millions of Syrians. So, and of course, you note that the Gulf states have weaponized sectarianism just as much. So I think there's something quite interesting, which obviously happens over this period, which is the sectarianization of conflicts across the region, and very much centered, of course, on the Syrian war. So what has been the impact of this, both in terms of, there's obviously a lot of spinning plates here, but we can take it in terms of Hezbollah and how it's seen, and also in terms of Assad, Syria, and how it was perceived.
Right. So, coming off of the 2006 33-day war that I was talking about, sort of Hassan Nasrallah usually topped sort of opinion polls in the Arab world as amongst sort of the most popular figures because, even though maybe mistaken to frame it as a victory, but the fact, that they had actually proven their ability to continue to actually launch missiles directly at the Israelis and, in a sense, bring about a ceasefire, which was, again, it was at a significant cost, but they had managed to survive and saw themselves as building upon that victory, as they saw it. Obviously, when we move to 2011, the Arab uprisings, which obviously take hold across the region, starting in Tunisia, moving to Egypt, but then obviously then Syria too. And as that uprising devolves into an armed conflict, a civil war in which sort of drew in basically geopolitical great powers, beyond the region as well as within the region. I mean, and again, the sectarianization of that conflict was already building on a prior kind of deep sort of sectarianization in politics of the region, which we saw in Iraq, of course. We can recall, King Abdullah talking about the Shia Crescent and Hosni Mubarak similarly, and the threat posed by Iran, because obviously, as I said, it's sort of the removal, the overthrow of Saddam Hussein was seen as actually tilting sort of the geopolitical balance of power in the region toward or in the favor of Iran very significantly. So the Syrian conflict is very much sort of coming out of this longer kind of trajectory. I think we need to see it in those terms, absolutely. And then the rise of sectarian actors, obviously, among the opposition. Of course, there were those who were pushing for a national kind of more democratic Syria, of course. But I think there's just no doubt that, the most powerful, sort of forceful actors eventually turned out to be, and there's a history there, it's a complicated one, which I won't get into. But for whatever reasons, sectarian actors on that side, Jabhat al-Nusra and obviously Islamic State and so on, become, very, very forceful. And very, very many, many others. Hayat al-Tahrir al-Sham later, so the group which the current Syrian president now, was the former kind of head of. And then obviously on the other side, as I mentioned, Hezbollah, Assad and Iran obviously do have this very strong, robust alliance. And that is very much the heart of the axis of resistance, for sure, if we want to use that term. And of course, Iran is invested in propping up and supporting Assad and ensuring that he basically survives this challenge, as is Hezbollah. And obviously their reasoning there is, very... it's geopolitical. It's we basically need the Assad government. We need this friendly government in power because obviously it's key for us having this sort of robust sort of supply lines into Lebanon so that we can actually act as a real meaningful check and have a deterrent with respect to the Israelis. And of course, this is in a sense, inevitably going to be put them at odds with the demands of those who were up, who rose up to overthrow. Yeah, for all intents and purposes, was a really abhorrent regime and really one of the more sort of notorious security states in the region. So that obviously Hezbollah coming to the aid of Assad, but also they have their own interests. And so far as I think they also, when you speak to people in Lebanon who are sympathetic to this line, they will say, I think, and there is truth to this, that they really did see a significant threat coming from these sectarian actors who were sort of also trying to come in to Lebanon and maybe in a sense sectarianize even further and intensify this sort of the sectarian rhetoric and conflict within Lebanon itself, which is already a highly kind of divided society in many ways. And of course, obviously, the significant Shia population within Lebanon was very worried about the rise of, particularly sort of Salafi jihadi types, because obviously there's a long also track record of, sectarian massacres. And this obviously happened on both sides, ultimately, as it transpired. And obviously the Assad regime itself, even though, it was a secular sort of Ba'athist social Arab nationalist regime, of course, and Hanna Batatu was the great Palestinian Marxist who wrote a really important book on Syria many years ago and wrote sort of a number of articles on this. He always made sort of the argument that because the Alawite minority was so, in a sense, under siege historically and had come to dominate the security services, the Assad regime was highly kind of reliant on not just the sort of fellow sectarians, sort of the Alawites, but those who were very much close to approximate to the same sort of family tribal ties of the Assad. So it did take on, again, this very sectarian character. But I think the real driver, at least for Hezbollah and Iran, it wasn't sectarian. It was really their geopolitical sort of drivers, which is what really forced them. And it's difficult to see kind of, from their perspective, what other options they could have had. I guess they could have sort of pushed harder for a reform process within Syria, perhaps. That maybe was a viable option. But as you see now, with sort of obviously what has ultimately transpired, the emergence of Gilani as sort of the current leader of Syria, sort of the Israelis' complete decimation of the Syrian sort of military following the fall of Assad. And now really it seems possibly some kind of imposed sort of normalization might occur while, of course, with the Golan Heights basically written off. So I think this was sort of, despite their best efforts, this was sort of the worst case scenario, I think, for Hezbollah and Iran, absolutely. And I think, I mean, there were a number of interesting leaks which came out by Iranian sort of military commanders as well, following the fall of Assad. And they were really very scathing, actually, about the Assad regime. And they sort of were saying it's just inveterately corrupt. It's not paying its troops. It's just beyond help, beyond sort of redemption. It's very revealing. And I think they themselves basically found themselves allied with somebody who they just thought was, which they felt compelled to support, but really they kind of, I think they saw the writing was on the wall. And that also explains why in December, when sort of her, when the HTS was just basically, you know, just racing through city after city within Syria, why they basically decided ultimately, I think, against committing further resources, because they just saw that, there was just no chance of recovering. This really, you know, absolutely, this sort of regime, which was just beyond salvaging at all.
Yeah, no, and I think it can't be understated how impactful it was for Iran to have to, in some ways, respond to Israel's attacks on Gaza and indeed attacks on Hezbollah in Lebanon and indeed on Syria in the context of having lost a regime which was viewed pretty existentially in terms of its own kind of regional plans and security. So I think the changed map, I mean, certainly for those who want to look at the region purely through the lens of what is going on in Palestine, you know, would be to miss some very important moves that have happened in the region.
Something that just bears repeating is that when you actually even read a lot of Iranian politicians, decision makers, people who are sort of in foreign policy commissions, security apparatus, they would always actually refer to the commitment to Syria, not because they're helping a sectarian, like a fellow sectarian, which again, that's a deeply problematic way of framing it, I mean, for various reasons. But they would always frame it as, in terms of national security, as I said, strategic depth, as basically if Assad falls, then we will be fighting at home. And even today now, after just the recent 12-day war, there's been a lot of statements sort of coming out, which again, reiterate this, as well, see, we told you. I mean, in a sense, saying we're vindicated, see, Assad fell, and now we're basically fighting on the home front. So it can't bear enough sort of repetition that, like, that's literally how the Islamic Republic itself did see this and framed it in exactly those sorts of terms.
We should probably turn already to certain questions internal to Iran as a way of trying to understanding the 12-day war and its actions there. So there was I think, and this is something that you explain, which is in reference to the period before the 7th of October attacks but certainly after, as far as I understand, though again, please correct me, that there's a faction within the political elite in Iran that would favor winding down Iran's support for its allies and the axis of resistance to pursue detente normalization with the US, and that Iranians themselves might be kind of exhausted on the Palestine question. As you put it, they're tired of being more Catholic than the Pope on the Palestine question and would prefer to turn to, more to their internal affairs and feel less responsibility for defending regional allies. How do you read this now, especially?
I mean, so just to sort of take a step back, I mean, so the more Catholic than the Pope sort of statement is referring to, I mean, I think it's important to say that obviously we have 46 years whereby the Palestinian central question and obviously opposition to Israel hegemony and so on was very much central. It's a central, death to Israel is obviously very much something which is repeated at, Friday prayer sermons. It's part of the official rhetoric. And sort of historically, a lot of obviously legitimacy more broadly in the Islamic world and regionally was gleaned from sort of trying to frame itself as very much a champion of the Palestinian cause. And its support for, Palestinian resistance movements. I mean, obviously Yasser Arafat famously was the first person to visit Tehran after the revolution. They gave him the key to the Israeli mission. And then subsequently Iran moved to support, obviously, Islamist factions like Hamas, which was their sort of preference, of course, over more secular actors. But yeah, I mean, the Iranian middle classes, I would say a significant chunk of the Iranian middle class, as well as a vocal and powerful faction within Iran itself, particularly those around people like Hassan Rouhani, the former president, or the former foreign minister, Javad Zarif, those who kind of form part of this constellation of the sort of more pragmatic wing in foreign ministry, but also on the domestic political scene, the so-called Karguzaran Sazandagi, so the executives of reconstruction who really trace their lineage back to another former president called Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, who again was very much a key architect of normalization with the Gulf states following the Iran-Iraq war, who was very much interested in sort of broader economic relations, both with Europe, but even potentially the United States as well. This faction, yeah, they basically quite often and frequently make this argument. And again, I think it's in line with a significant chunk of opinion within Iran itself, like more particularly among urban middle classes, absolutely, that, you know, this is a costly sort of policy. It's costing Iran money, like in terms of, you know, blood and treasure, for sure. And it's actually resulting in our isolation from the world. It's resulted in sanctions. It's basically generated these conditions for enmity against us. And this is, I'm talking about, this is not my opinion. This is sort of, I'm just sort of repeating how they see it. And therefore, Iran needs to sort of put this to one side and needs to basically, and, you know, put this to one side and actually pursue a policy in which, you know, quote unquote, the national interest is front and center and Iran isn't getting involved and embroiled in these sorts of conflicts which have nothing to do with it, right? But the interesting thing here, which I think is important to note, like for your listeners, is that the other side of the coin, I mean, they make the argument for sort of the axis of resistance and why Iran has a responsibility to support these various groups. And they make that argument, yeah, sure, they'll nod to pan-Islamic solidarity. We have this responsibility to the Palestinian people, you know, all these sorts of things, you know, given the fact that the horrific kind of sort of war crimes and massacres and occupation and so on and so forth, we have this obligation to do that. But really, the often, you know, their argument, the sort of the core of it is, again, to say, the heart of it is to say, you know, like I was saying earlier, that we need to do this because this ensures actually our security at home, on the home front, in a sense. So in a sense, they're both different kinds of nationalist argument, if you think about it, but it's more like the methods by which the national interest is secured, which is different. And obviously those who talk about the axis of resistance says, okay, but we are, you know, the United States has this, you know, sort of irreparable enmity towards us, you know, which, you know, could make the case. I think it's quite plausible. At least the security, you know, the national security state within the United States, given the hostage crisis and all the baggage there. You know, we don't have access to US weapons. We don't have, you know, we've got all of these sort of shortcomings as a result of our sort of historic isolation. So we've built up this sort of unconventional means, asymmetrical kind of tactics, but still to basically to advance a strategy which is provide security for Iran more broadly, right? So I think it's important to note that, rather, like I said, the arguments have a certain symmetry, even though they're quite, like I said, the way they think the best way to go about it is very different. And there's a lot of, you know, polemical exchanges over this within Iran and within Iranian debates.
Right. I mean, that's interesting insofar as it underscores how little kind of revolutionary ideological content there is to it, that it's kind of very much framed in nationalist terms exclusively. I want to ask specifically about the you know, the so-called 12-day war. I'm still not sold on calling it the 12-day war. I still haven't really got my head around what it was, how close to a wider configuration it actually was. And maybe you have a take on this. And indeed, I mean, there was an article published in Sidecar, the new Left Review's blog, on the 17th of June, where it was quite ominous. I remember reading it as soon as it came out. And then, you know, very shortly after, the conditions looked radically altered and it was all over. And it was unclear kind of how to relate to what had just happened. So to quote from, I think, from that article, if I'm not mistaken, Washington's primary ambition in the Middle East has been to secure Israeli normalization with the absolutist monarchies of the Gulf, and Saudi Arabia in particular, and that this would create a favorable security settlement in the region, diminishing Iranian influence on the one hand and bypassing the Palestinian issue. And indeed, that seems to be what has more or less happened. On the other hand, Israel's strategy seemed to be quite maximalist, which you also note. It was quite clear what that would look like, decapitating the Iranian leadership, decapitating the leadership of Hamas and Hezbollah, and drawing the U.S. into a regime change operation in Iran. And it didn't get that, but it did get some of that. And, I mean, Israel is obviously kind of the big winner geostrategically from the past 2 years. My reading is that Iran's posture was mostly defensive, or at least kind of interested in maintaining the balance of deterrence. Iran lost. I mean, it lost in many important ways, and Iran has lost in many important ways, as you've just been detailing, you know, over the past decade, really. But it didn't lose bigly, as Trump might have might put it. So, what's your reading on what the 12-day war was? You know, you as a historian, I don't know if you can already at this stage say if you can label it as something, and how close was it to an all-out war, or indeed a kind of regime change operation on the U.S.'s part? On whom did this depend? How much room for maneuver and decision-making capacity and autonomy did Iran have in this whole story? And was it all, or alternatively, was it all dependent on what the U.S. decided to do and whom Trump was listening to?
I mean, I'm with you in terms of we're still trying to figure out exactly how things actually transpired and why they took the turns that they did, and it's very difficult, and therefore everything is said with, you know, ample caveats. But I do think the Israeli sort of government, I guess, had, I mean, and I'm pretty sure this was, you know, planned closely with probably the Department of Defense and, you know, the CIA and the United States, and there's ample, you know, intelligence sharing and all these sorts of things. But I think I think the Netanyahu government probably did have these maximalist aims. I think they basically, I mean, they had two sets of aims, I would say. They had the maximalist ones, which was obviously, yeah, let's bring about the collapse of the Iranian state through this decapitation strategy, and people will rise up and overthrow the regime. And I think they thought this could be a consequence of this sort of, you know, decapitation strategy, and then proceeding to bomb, you know, the state TV and all these sorts of things. I think, yeah, and even Evin prison, where they, you know, I think hundreds at this point, maybe close to hundreds of people were killed, many of them social workers or inmates. And so I think there was this maximalist strategy, absolutely, which I think was probably sold to the Trump administration. But I think there were another set of aims, which was obviously the two ones, which obviously degrading Iran's ballistic missile program and anti-ballistic missile defense and defense systems, for sure. And as well as obviously drawing in the United States to attack the nuclear installations in Iran and in Natanz and Esfahan and Fordo, particularly. And Fordo is the most important one, because obviously it's the one that's sort of buried within a mountain, which Israel couldn't ultimately destroy on its own at all, and there was even doubts whether the United States could do that at all. And obviously, we know that they would use these sort of 30,000-pound multiple bunker buster bombs to attack that installation. And obviously, you know, the American president insists that it was utterly obliterated. But I think there is a lot of more ambivalence, and even before the strike, there was even a lot of doubts actually whether even these these bunker buster bombs, you know, the biggest sort of non-nuclear bombs kind of ever used in historically speaking, could even destroy the Fordo facility as well. And then, you know, reports that have come out, and again, one has to be so careful how we read these, but I know both by the head of the IAEA and other reports seem to indicate that actually maybe the damage wasn't so severe. Maybe Iran did manage to remove its more advanced centrifuges and also the 400-kilogram highly enriched sort of stockpile of uranium as well. And the fact of the matter, I mean, anyone who pretends that they have answers to this is basically, you know, I would take it with a really big pinch of salt. And we really are actually living right now in a moment of very serious kind of strategic ambiguity. As I said, I think the Israelis had these sort of maximalist aims when that didn't necessarily cash out, because obviously after decapitating many of sort of the leading generals of the armed forces, of the Revolutionary Guard, even sort of one of the kind of really important figures in the negotiations, Ali Shamkhani, who kind of survived, I think they did probably have this idea that Iran would basically fold and maybe complete or total capitulation would occur, if not sort of regime collapse. And I think basically it probably was sold to the Trump administration that, yes, this would probably bring about total capitulation. And then you can say you achieved what, you know, the Obama administration never could, namely complete capitulation of the Iranian government. They're going to basically give up their kind of rights on the NPT to enrich uranium for civilian purposes. And you would have achieved this, and you're the greatest president, American president ever in history, and so on. So I think Trump was probably sold this more limited thing, and they probably thought like a byproduct would be the maximalist sort of outcome. At the same time, obviously, in Iran, that didn't happen. Very quickly, you know, the chain of command managed to regroup. And really, yeah, they managed to inflict very, very serious, you know, it wasn't inconsequential at all. They did inflict serious sort of costs. You know, there were thousands upon thousands of insurance claims that had been logged now. They hit the Weizmann Institute, which is obviously a famous scientific sort of institute within Israel. They hit the Haifa oil refinery as well. And also there was sort of a media blackout. And I don't know if you saw this Telegraph report, which showed that basically Iran had managed to obviously sort of launch and sort of very similar strikes on major air bases within Israel. I guess the question is, and we don't really know, this is just simply through, I guess, reading very circumstantially the evidence, but obviously, yeah, Israel was still able to launch aerial strikes upon Iran. It managed to, even before this, obviously take, you know, seriously degrade its air defenses. And now there's sort of reports coming out that Iran has gone to China and is actually trying to secure these new forms of anti-ballistic missile sort of defense systems. So, you know, it's like you said, I think it is very much a conflict which is not been resolved. The nuclear issue, question is not resolved, absolutely. And the sort of ambiguity that we're living in, I mean, it basically allows both the Israelis to say that we need another campaign, potentially, in order to basically really ensure that Iran's sort of latent deterrent capacity, nuclear sort of deterrent capacity, is completely taken care of, is addressed sort of decisively. But at the minute, it seems that the Trump administration is very keen to say that, you know, this was decisive, and actually Iran is, for the moment at least, is on the back foot. And it does seem that they are trying to maybe leverage this into some kind of negotiation, but where it will lead is really unclear, because obviously if the Trump administration continues to want to say that, you know, Iran needs to completely give up its right to enrich for civilian purposes, yeah, I don't think they had a significant of a victory, as it were, to impose that at the minute. And I think it's going to be, even if sort of Iran is very much open to negotiating, and they are going to continue to negotiate, it seems. I don't think they're willing to, they're not going to sort of opt for the complete surrender option, which I think would allow Trump to then say that he's achieved something which the Obama administration couldn't.
Right. And I mean, it does seem to me that what is decisive here is less what happened in the 12-day war and more what we've been talking about preceding that, which is to say the fall of Assad and Israeli's decapitations of leaderships of Hezbollah in particular, and Hamas to an extent as well. And that probably more sets the scene to what is going on and what will happen than specifically the 12-day war, where I guess it was affirmed what everybody already knew, that the Israelis, as you've been saying, have the capacity to mount quite deadly attacks on Iran, but Iran still maintains this capacity to exert some harm in return, even if it doesn't have kind of nuclear second strike capacity or something like that. What my reading from it is also that what would be decisive is that surely Iran decides now we must have nuclear weapons. I mean, for the continuation of the regime, if it's possible for them to develop nuclear weapons, surely they must. I mean, that's one of the big lessons from not just this 12-day war, but indeed the last 20 years of 20 plus years of history. I mean, well, you know, since 9/11, really.
Yeah, I mean, so just before I address that, I would say that actually Iran did keep certain things in reserve and certain cards which it didn't play. So, well, of course, you know, Hezbollah was degraded very severely. I still think they do have the capacity actually to re-enter the fray, but I think actually they didn't, and Iran didn't even ask because of the heavy domestic cost within Lebanon, because obviously if Iran really was reaching a sort of a point of existential crisis, I mean, Hezbollah would see it also as an existential crisis for them too. So it would probably necessitate them to maybe enter the fray again. Similarly, I mean, even with Ansarullah, while they don't sort of take orders from Tehran, that's sort of the, you know, a sort of ridiculous caricature, they might perhaps also resort again to sort of targeting shipping in the Bab al-Mandab Strait. And actually, so there are cards, but also there's the Strait of Hormuz, which I think is sort of like a last, sort of a policy of last resort. But again, that's also something which they threaten, and they haven't played that card yet. And I think that is actually speaks to the fact that while they sort of paid a very heavy cost, and they had a very heavy cost sort of inflicted upon them, they still have actually several cards that they can play, even in terms of, you know, of what remains of the axis of resistance. So I think like one needs to be careful not to overstate it too much. But I think like, yeah, of course, it's been very, very severely weakened. But there are certain things which I think they could play, which they did, and which they decided against in this first round, because I think they probably do anticipate that there might be, you know, further rounds to come. And I'm sure they have no illusions how fragile the current cessation of hostilities. I'm kind of even sort of reluctant to call it a ceasefire, really. But yeah, on the question of the nuclear terror, it's interesting, actually. Like, you get lots of now sort of Iranian pundits really citing John Mearsheimer and saying, look, John Mearsheimer saying that, you know, you guys really should have, we really need to have a nuclear deterrent. And that's the only thing that will actually resolve the issue. But I mean, you know, the reality of it is that we don't really know whether they have the enriched stockpile. We don't know if they have, I mean, you know, people indicate that maybe they're, you know, they still have centrifuges underground, and they could pursue a highly enriched sort of uranium bomb. But then, you know, as I think all the experts conclude, you know, turning that into the metal necessary that you can act, and then having it sort of putting it into a delivery system and all these sorts of things is itself a very complex technical process. And sure, maybe they could basically do a sort of drop a bomb in the desert and show that, yeah, we have this capacity. But I think, yeah, it's quite a difficult one. For the minute, they have suspended cooperation with the IAEA. And it seems that, you know, they're not pursuing the nuclear deterrent option. If anything, it seems that they're kind of pursuing their past sort of strategy. So I think one of the good things is to make clear, I think, or just to add, is that my sense of one of the reasons why they stepped up uranium is because, you know, they see that as a card to play. They basically see that as something that they could barter away. So it was, in a sense, a threat, but it was something that you could actually eventually barter away. And I think similarly with the suspension of cooperation with the IAEA, like, they haven't left. And obviously they haven't left for the reasons because they think that would immediately be kind of used as a pretext to kind of refer them to the UN Security Council and so on. And also, they probably don't want to alienate their Gulf allies more. They don't want to, obviously, China and Russia aren't invested in Iran having a nuclear deterrent either. So there's just general been very serious opposition to that. And my sense is that you know, I could be wrong. Maybe they are now covertly running to do it. And, you know, and it's sort of, I think, you know, the fact of the matter, as we've seen, the Iranian state is so penetrated by clearly people adjacent to or linked to Israeli intelligence. They've managed to kind of, on repeated occasions, to kind of insinuate themselves into it, right? So if they did make that decision, it's very likely that it would leak, like, relatively quickly, right? So I think there's various things here. So there's one, there's the difficulty of doing it. It would take a significant amount of time. And two, there's a very serious chance that it could leak. And finally, like, I think, you know, they're pursuing the strategy which they have previously, which is basically bartering it. They want to basically use it as leverage. And I think, to be honest, I think, like, if we go back to October 2023, one of the major kind of shortcomings, you could say, of Iranian strategy in terms of how they've been reading the Israelis and the United States, I think, is that they've been basically following a kind of a protocol or a modus operandi, which previously would have worked, that, okay, you strike at us, we'll do it with a slightly lesser force, or we'll do something which is a kind of a tit for tat, and this should kind of make you think twice, and this sort of reestablishes sort of the balance, and then we can do that again. And this is exactly what they did. We're following the Israeli strike on the embassy in Damascus in April 2024, I think. And then also following even sort of the assassination of Haniyeh, which nothing in Tehran, like, no sort of immediate response. It was only when Nasrallah was basically killed, and really it was just for credibility, that I think they felt they had to do a sort of a more significant response, which was then in late September, October 2024. So they basically are playing this quite calibrated, pragmatic game, because they don't want it to escalate, because they fear that it might get out of control. Whereas, yeah, the Netanyahu administration has been, in a sense, calling their bluff and pursuing the much more radical, I would say, kind of path and saying, okay, well, no, we're actually going to take this really extreme action. Like, you know, previously they wouldn't have thought of assassinating Nasrallah, for instance. Like, you know, that wouldn't have, I think, been maybe on the cards. But no, by doing that, I mean, he's pushed the dial. And Iran still kind of did a relatively, I would say, calibrated response. And even now, I mean, even following, if you think, following the United States, obviously, attack, like direct attack on Iran's nuclear facilities, I mean, what did Iran do? I mean, it obviously was firing at Israel, obviously, and had this sustained period. But I mean, with respect to the United States, they did this quite symbolic just strike at the Al Udeid air base in Qatar, right? And again, it was sort of, again, signaling, saying, we don't want this to escalate out of control. And why is that the case? Because I think it's because, you know, they're very concerned about the domestic repercussions, the instability that it could bring about at home, that it could exacerbate sort of longstanding tensions and grievances. And, you know, so I think the precarious situation at home, also just the massive imbalance of power, which they're not fools. I mean, you know, in this sense, we can think of them as rational. They understand that, like, a massive escalation with the United States is not going to, no one's going to benefit from that, really. So,
No, I mean, so, I think the regional balance of power and the regime's relative, you know, each regime's relative stability, I speak about specifically Iran and Israel, can be read off very much from the actions around the 12-day war, and specifically Israel's actions, which, you know, were not crazy, right? I mean, Israel's very dangerous in terms of stability, peace, etc., but they're not crazy insofar as it is reflective of Israel's relative power in the region now, in a region which has been pretty much transformed over the past
couple of years. I mean, I think he just knew the public opinion where it was in Israel. I think it was overwhelmingly in support. Because obviously, I mean, you know, Iran has been seen as this sort of just immortal, bête noire enemy state, which is just hell-bent on the destruction of Israel and so on. So, I mean, there was a huge amount of support, and I think of support for it. And I think Netanyahu had a huge kind of boost, actually.
Well, and I think Netanyahu knows probably if war stops, he's gone, or at least that there's a risk of that. Whereas for the Iranian leadership's calculus is perhaps the opposite. We can't have war, otherwise we're gone. And maybe that, I don't know if that that's a too simplistic reading of affairs, but I do note that.
No, it's not. So actually, I mean, just to sort of riff off what you were saying, I think if you look even sort of the election of Pezeshkian, I mean, his whole platform was sort of getting sanctions relief, improving relations with the world, quote unquote, but like obviously the United States here, and obviously, you know, negotiating directly, you know, with the United States. I mean, that was absolutely on his sort of his platform to be elected. I mean, and that's because, you know, on the one hand, yeah, there's part of the Iranian bourgeoisie who does want this, but also, you know, there's a very significant sort of part of the Iranian populace. I mean, like middle classes, lower middle classes, who also, you know, have been devastated by, you know, just decades of sanctions and economic isolation and so on. So there was sort of a lot of kind of grassroots pressure, you know, which is obviously mediated through Iran's rather often like Byzantine kind of electoral system. And then obviously part of the Iranian elite itself, which sort of has seen, you know, I mean, Rouhani famously said when he was elected, he says, yeah, the centrifuges can turn and spin, but as long as actually the economy is also kind of working and spinning as well, you know. So, I mean, you know, there was very similar demands for that. So, you know, the fact that it took this turn, in a sense, you know, Pezeshkian was not meant to be a wartime president under any circumstances.
Mm. So, I mean, drawing towards an end here, I wanted to ask one thing that's been noted about Iran in the past month is that the regime is leaning quite heavily into Iranian nationalism and symbols which indeed predate the revolution, which seems to me, as far as my understanding is, that that's fairly novel. I wonder what your reading is of this. What's the content of this nationalism? And does it, I guess it stands in contrast to kind of Shia sectarianism and to revolutionary Islamism. It's an attempt to perhaps bolster the regime's stability and feed off of and kind of feed back into the sort of rally around the flag sentiment that's emerged in Iran. How do you see this playing out? And I mean, is this a way home for the regime, you know, like in terms of maintaining its stability? Yeah, obviously this is in the context, it's worth recalling for, it's something that we've discussed a number of times on this podcast, but, you know, Iran has seen a series of major protests and uprisings over the past decade. So I think anything that the mullahs do have to be analyzed in that light.
So I do think, like, you know, Iranian nationalism broadly, and obviously that's conceived depending on who you speak to in a variety of ways. I do think it is deep. It is resilient. I mean, often this idea that, you know, that nationalism is transient and is ultimately going to sort of dissipate and be replaced by sort of more universalistic, solidaristic kind of forms of identity. You know, it's an aspiration, I guess. But I think nationalism is really is robust. And obviously, there were people who maybe did rally behind the state, but there were obviously a lot of people who are just invested very clearly in the idea of, yeah, Iran as a nation state. Mm. And, you know, really are very, there's a deep sense of attachment and defensiveness regarding notions of sort of territorial integrity. And obviously this has, you know, long roots going back to sort of the 19th century. I mean, we could talk about when Iran was sort of divided de facto in sort of at the very beginning of the 20th century between Imperial Russia and Britain, sort of the rather unsavory history of the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, and, you know, and British Petroleum today. You know, obviously, the nationalist crisis, sort of the nationalization crisis during the government of Mohammad Mossadegh, the 53 coup, and all these sorts of things. So there is sort of a, you know, and obviously even the run-up actually to the revolution itself. Obviously, the United States was seen as sort of this foremost patron of this sort of monarchical dictatorship, which was deeply, you know, resented and detested in the run-up to the revolution. So, and yeah, a lot of those about safeguarding Iran's independence, being a strong, powerful, sovereign country. And yeah, people who are Islamists, for instance. So, I mean, just to give you an example, Akbar Hashmi Rafsanjani, who became the president in the 90s, who I was talking about, he actually, before the revolution, wrote a book about a chap who was sort of a well-known Qajar-era reformer called Amir Kabir, who was seen as kind of modernizing the state and making and basically pushing back against imperial predations and all these sorts of things to build up and modernize Iran. And he actually wrote a book about it before the revolution. So even sort of a figure like that, you know, is invested because I guess they've gone through the Pahlavi system. They're subjected to the, you know, they've gone through all of those institutions and internalized that to a significant degree. And I would say the Islamic Republic, obviously the revolution, I'd say, would be where this kind of went to the margins somewhat. But even then, you had the Iran-Iraq war in which, you know, Iran was a significant and seen as a significant potent force. And there was a lot of leaning into nationalism even then, even though, of course, there was a lot of obviously Shia Islamist rhetoric as well, of course, which was also very foundational there. But I would say, and as I was saying to you before we started recording, I mean, really since maybe the late 90s, the notion of sort of, yeah, Iranian nation and Iranian identity, civic forms of nationalism have become increasingly kind of prominent. Mm. And even someone like Ahmadinejad, who at the time often in the West was being portrayed as, you know, some wacky millenarian fundamentalist, actually, Iran was really kind of central to a lot of his discourse and rhetoric. And there's sort of pictures of him sort of putting like a Palestinian kufiya around sort of the neck of sort of an actor playing Cyrus the Great. And so they were very much, and he often spoke about sort of Iranian civilization, the greatness of Iranian civilization, and so on. And I think so the Iranian state, because obviously, I guess, the lack of or the decreasing or diminishing legitimacy of the broader kind of Islamist, pan-Islamist, Islamic populist discourse and rhetoric has turned to more and more, yeah, different forms of Iranian nationalism. And some of these, you know, it could be a more secular form, but yeah, more like a Shi-centric, I would say, Shi-populist Iranian nationalism, sort of fusing these two together and seeing them as absolutely profoundly intertwined and entangled. And so you have people who have still bought into that and lean into that. And like, so after this even, obviously, we're now in the month of Muharram, where in the first 10 days, Shia Muslims mourn the martyrdom of the grandson of the Prophet, Imam Hussein. And basically, Shias traditionally sort of perform elegies, sort of mourning his martyrdom. And a lot of these across the country took a really quite nationalist turn as well. I'm talking like in really an official circle. So even, you know, in the household of Ayatollah Khamenei, where they have kind of these mourning sort of ceremonies there, and they basically performed these sort of rituals, basically centering, you know, Iran, Vatan. Vatan is basically a name for homeland as well. So very centering the homeland. So this is very much entered official discourse. They're using this. They understand that this has some cachet. But yeah, is it going to basically solve all of their problems? No, of course not, because I guess there's sort of, there are, of course, you know, deeper economic contradictions, you know, in terms of certain, like, maybe neoliberal economic policies, which have long been pursued or increasingly favored, right? So that's not going to necessarily solve those issues. There's, you know, there's the gender question, of course, which is a long-standing one. And there was, you know, historically lots of grievances. We saw like an uprising in part, at least in response to that, very much where women had a very, very prominent kind of role. And yeah, I think the government's response to that has been rather somewhat pragmatic in kind of selectively policing and kind of really letting people do their own thing and not, in a sense, in going out of their way to antagonize the population. And I think there was a lot of actually relief. Yeah, maybe that's maybe the best way of putting it. But there was a lot of, in a sense, relief by when Ibrahim Raisi was killed in this helicopter crash. And they could see this pivot to a kind of a more pragmatic, reformist-leaning kind of president and administration. There was a sense that there's, you know, this government is not going to pursue kind of this very willful, intentional, like antagonization of like half the population. And that has simmered down, I would say, some of the contradictions and sort of hostility and animosity in that regard. But it's still like an ongoing issue, of course, right? So, yeah, I think it's sort of managed crisis. And I think the Islamic Republic is going to continue to have to manage this crisis because obviously following this war as well, it's not just obviously the actual military aspect, of course, and maybe the next round of this. It's also the real issue of now increased capital flight, which already had been huge amounts. Like I'm talking like tens and tens of billions into places like in Turkey, where people are buying real estate, to Canada, to so on, you know, elsewhere. So it's more in the sort of also the economic repercussions of this and this kind of perpetual kind of state of crisis and managed crisis, which, you know, the Islamic Republic is, I always say, like, one shouldn't underestimate it because they really have always been in crisis, really from a revolution through to a war. And there's been only brief periods where you've had relative kind of calm. Then you had obviously the Iraq war, the invasion of Iraq in 2003. So it's been constantly sort of managing threats, crises and so on. And this is a kind of another round. It is intensified. But like I said, they've shown themselves quite adept. But, you know, I mean, unfortunately, we can see probably, you know, increased levels of repression in certain arenas as well, which will come out of this. Already, I mean, we've seen in relation to this nationalist kind of populist discourse, which I was talking about, there has been some increased demonization of Afghan refugees in Iran. So, you know, Iran is sort of home to about 4 to 6 million, like, Afghan, which is a huge amount. Afghan, obviously, which have come out as a result of, you know, the invasion of Afghanistan, Taliban rule and so on, which, you know, has all sorts of consequences within Iran. But you can imagine, like in the UK where I am, like 6 million people kind of refugees, like sort of the political kind of backlash to that. And Iran, there has been historically. And obviously the government there is trying to, in some sense, use this and use the war as a pretext, I think, as an excuse to kind of also eject en masse many kind of Afghan refugees. So it will have a, you know, there will be this nationalist kind of side to it, but there will have be a more ugly side as well. And there will be, unfortunately, yeah, some support for this. I mean, I think it would be like, you know, it wouldn't be accurate to say that, you know, the Iranians are going to be horrified by the fact that, you know, some might, but I think many will be, you know, will be indifferent, possibly. So yeah, I think this is the situation. We're going to see ongoing fragility and managed crisis in the months to come, absolutely.
All right, fantastic. Though actually, just quickly before we end, I did want to reflect on the fact that by all intents and purposes, it seems like Hamas's intention with the 7th of October attacks was to interrupt, it was kind of a last-ditch attempt to interrupt the normalization process between Israel and Saudi Arabia. And that's an important kind of regional piece of the puzzle, which we didn't touch on. So, I mean, how do you read that now? And how do you read what's going to happen in light of, well, in light of all that's happened since the 7th of October?
Yeah, so it did seem before the 7th of October that sort of Israel and Saudi Arabia were on course for sort of actual like normalization and possibly Saudi Arabia entering into the Abraham Accords, which are currently with, you know, the UAE and Bahrain. And that was sort of seen as this really important achievement during the Trump administration, despite the fact that neither the UAE or Bahrain were really ever at war with the Israeli state. But I think the big prize, of course, was Saudi Arabia. And then given obviously what's unfolded in Gaza and just the sheer level of the catastrophe sort of that's unfolded there and been inflicted upon the people there, it was obviously very costly for Saudi Arabia to enter into this. But then increasingly, I guess, yes, with the maximalist sort of very aggressive policy pursued by the Netanyahu administration, you know, basically going in within 20 miles of Damascus and, you know, very much clobbering Hezbollah and so on, and then striking at Iran, has actually made Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states far more wary of the prospects of sort of unchecked sort of Israeli hegemon, you know, or sort of dominant power in the region. So I think actually, obviously, maybe part of actually the reasons why I think Yahya Sinwar thought it was, you know, a key reason for launching October 7th was actually to, you know, to put an end to this process of normalization, I guess, the circumvention of the Palestinian question. So in this sense, you could argue, despite, you know, the horrendous cost, I mean, this has proved successful for the minute. But also, I mean, one of the things that actually stood out to me throughout the 12-day war as well was that Iran was actually constantly signaling to the Gulf states that it's the more kind of responsible, measured actor here. And they actually really wanted to make that clear because they're very worried. They were very sort of clear that if they took a like radical action and threatened the Gulf states, then in a sense they would be then compelled or feel compelled possibly to then really swing back to the sort of the Trump and sort of Netanyahu kind of alliance. And actually they didn't. And they very vociferously condemned actually the attack on Iran, including Saudi Arabia. So, and I think, yeah, given that Iran is obviously in a much weaker position, the fact of the matter is that Turkey really was the major sort of, I guess, beneficiary of what transpired in Syria and the fall of Assad. I mean, that much is very, very clear. Iran is obviously severely weakened as a result of the last 2 years. And therefore, yeah, it's also seen less of a threat, in comparison to previous years. So, yeah, sort of the impetus behind that, I think, is dissipated. They're going to be very reluctant because of obviously Gaza and also a weakened Iran. And it doesn't seem to be on the cards, even though it does appear that the Trump administration is going to continue to push this. And I think he did make some rather quirky, as he does, you know, comments in this regard. But yeah, I don't think it's going to be on the cards. And actually, what's been interesting is the Saudis have been quite clear that barring a resolution to the Palestinian question and Palestinian sway, that they're not going to, the normalization is a non-starter.
Well, yet another thing that's shifted. And as you note, Iran's relative weakening over this period has maybe made it less important for the Saudis to seek this alliance with the Israelis. Anyway, fascinating stuff. I appreciate it's always difficult to try to paint a picture of the region and to talk about the Middle East without kind of a map in front of you. I mean, quite literally, because of the web of alliances and everything is quite complex, and you've done an excellent job of trying to depict it for us.
I tried.
Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Great to talk to you.